Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. We will stay windy for the rest of this afternoon. Blowing dust advisories in effect for the valley until 8 o'clock tonight, looking to top out at 97. Should be partly cloudy and breezy tonight with lows in the mid-60s, and then a major change tomorrow, slight chance of rain with a high of 81. Currently with relative humidity at 7%, it's partly cloudy and 95 degrees.
Attorneys for Leslie Merritt Jr. have asked a judge to permanently dismiss all charges against him. As KJZZ's Matthew Casey reports from the West Valley Bureau, they've accused prosecutors of trying to delay trial and gain an advantage.
Merritt's attorneys wrote that prosecutors made a, quote, desperate attempt to salvage a botched investigation by asking a judge to leave the door open for them to refile charges. The court granted prosecutors' request, and the statute of limitations gives them another 6-plus years to refile charges. Merritt's attorneys say the state really wanted to delay a June 9th trial to do more forensic tests, and that violates Merritt's due process rights. Merritt was released from jail after an independent ballistics expert was unable to confirm a DPS report that the bullets came from Merritt's gun. Matthew Casey, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The Arizona House has again rejected a bill that would stiffen sentences for immigrants in the country illegally. The House failed to adopt the proposal on a 31-29 vote Thursday after lawmakers reconsidered the bill under House rules. The chamber had already defeated the bill once before. Republican Senator Steve Smith sponsored the measure that essentially would make it impossible for immigrants in the country illegally to receive any leniency in the courts when they commit serious crimes. Senate Bill 1377 would require people who break immigration laws and are found guilty of felonies to serve at least a presumptive terms without the possibility for probation or release until that sentence is served.
Questions about dark money spending continue to cloud Arizona's Public Utilities Commission, but a showdown could be close. Yesterday, Attorney General Mark Brnovich issued an opinion that finds a corporation commissioner does have the power to demand that public service corporations turn over records related to lobbying and political spending, among other things. This could have big implications for one commissioner and the state's largest utility, and KJZZ's Will Stone is here to explain how. So, Will, what's the backstory? Why did Attorney General Brnovich issue this opinion?
Well, Steve, for months, Corporation Commissioner Bob Burns has been wrangling with Arizona Public Service over what's alleged to be about $3 million in dark money spending on commission races back in the 2014 election cycle. It's believed that APS and/or its parent company, Pinnacle West, are behind that spending, essentially to help get certain favorable commissioners elected. APS doesn't confirm or deny it, but public scrutiny has been building over, you know, the last year or so, and Corporation Commissioner Bob Burns has taken up the cause. He says the dark money spending could undermine the public's trust, and let's take a listen to what he told me earlier this year.
If behavior is questionable or perceived to be unacceptable, then I think as a regulator elected by the people of this state, I have a responsibility to take some action.
So Burns has asked that the companies turn over financial records related to political and lobbying spending. He says he's granted that authority under the Constitution, but so far APS has steadfastly refused. So Burns upped the stakes. He went to the Attorney General to get an opinion on whether he actually has that power.
And what did Brnovich decide?
His opinion came down strongly in favor of Burns. He says an individual commissioner does have the authority to demand that a public service corporation reveal its charitable, political, and lobbying spending, and also to examine personnel under oath. I mean, don't forget the commission is a quasi-legal entity, and so Burns doesn't even apparently need the help of other commissioners to exercise the subpoena power. Among its arguments, APS had contended that because their spending is totally separate from the money made on ratepayers, that commissioners shouldn't be able to open their books and look at that, and that also it's a violation of free speech. But this opinion, while it's not binding, it does undercut APS's argument up till now.
So what about the question of APS parent company Pinnacle West? Some are speculating contributions could have come from there as well. Can Burns ask for those records?
That's a little less clear. The opinion does state that the commission, not just a single commissioner, but the a majority, can force an affiliate of a public service corporation, such as Pinnacle West, to disclose that information, so long as that's relevant to their job as rate makers and the functioning. Most people watching the commission and the politics there think that's unlikely to happen because other commissioners have come out against Burns' effort to get this information. The chairman has even written editorials arguing this is really not necessary for them to do. But at the very end of the opinion, Brnovich does imply that one commissioner might actually be able to get that information from Pinnacle West. Here's how Ryan Anderson, who's with the Attorney General's office, explains it.
There's a legal case to be made as to whether the Arizona Constitution and or previous court cases extend individual authority to inspect the records of non-public service companies which offer stock for sale to the public.
So there you go. That could be Pinnacle West, but Anderson made it clear that while they consider this one of the most important opinions they've issued, this really answers a narrow set of legal questions, and what happens from here will probably be up to the commission and APS.
KJZZ's Will Stone. Will, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
Navajo lawmakers have approved a $150 million bill that supporters say would serve as a stimulus for the nation. It'll allocate $30 million a year for 5 years in areas including water infrastructure, agriculture projects, and economic development. Lorenzo Bates is the Navajo Nation Council Speaker, and he joins me. So, Speaker Bates, how big are the needs that this money would attempt to address?
It's significant in terms of, one, it'll create jobs. Up to 400 jobs during the construction phase. And then it'll create jobs after the convenience stores are developed. It'll create an economy in the agricultural industry. It'll create a tax base for those communities that may have a tax ordinance that would allow a community to collect the taxes. If a community doesn't, then that creates a tax base for those dollars to come back to the Navajo Nation.
You referenced convenience stores. What kinds of other projects would this bill allow for?
It's separated up in 5 years, for 5 years over a period of time. The first box is for the municipal water systems. The convenience stores in the communities that are shovel-ready for construction of a convenience store. It'll also do a hotel in Shiprock. It'll also create needed offices within the central government. It'll provide the dollars needed for existing farmlands. Because one of the things that we were hearing was we would like to bring farming back to our communities. That also creates economic development because those same individuals that raise crops can sell, and they can also, by virtue of the gaming industry where they promote by Navajo, those farmers can create a possible co-op to sell their produce.
How much work has to happen for the Navajo Nation to bring back agriculture to the point where you'd like to see it?
A considerable amount.
Is there space, I guess, for lack of a better word, in the economy of the Navajo Nation for both more farming and agriculture and livestock, but also more of the other kind of economic development you were talking about earlier with convenience stores and hotels and gaming and things like that?
Agriculture is separate by itself. When you look to the C-stores, we have the border towns surrounding Navajo. We as Navajos go to those border towns to expend our dollars. Very little comes back to the Navajo Nation. The TPT tax that exists, Navajo contributes upwards of $25-ish million. How much of those dollars are returned back to the Navajo Nation for economic development, for infrastructure, for roads? None. The more convenience stores, the more businesses that are created on Navajo, those taxes that would otherwise go to the state of Arizona remain on Navajo.
Lorenzo Bates is the Navajo Nation Council Speaker. Speaker Bates, thank you very much.
You bet. Thank you, sir.
As voters weigh the pros and cons of education funding, Proposition 123, school districts across the valley are left trying to plan for two very different futures. The show's Lauren Gilger takes us to Mesa to find out more.
Josh Buckley has been a teacher in Arizona for the last 10 years.
And so the first 4 years of teaching, essentially every year was, do I have a job next year?
Now he teaches economics to seniors at Dobson High School in Mesa, and he's the vice president of the Mesa Education Association, which lobbies on behalf of teachers in the district.
But that happened to lots of teachers.
Every year during the second semester, they meet once a week to go over the budget for the coming year.
How much money has the district received this year? Are there any cuts to the district this year? And then working out what that means for salary, what does that mean for benefits?
But this year, things are a little different.
This year, we are doing really two budgets.
One, if Proposition 123 passes.
Or we work on a budget without Prop 123, where those monies aren't there.
Proposition 123 is asking voters statewide to approve a plan to inject $300 million a year into the state's K-12 education system by pulling money out of the state's trust lands for the next decade. Voters are set to decide if the measure passes on May 17th. But until then, many school districts in the valley are trying to plan for both scenarios, and they're miles apart.
So if you want to know what the difference for Mesa Public Schools is, with Prop 123, we would see approximately $21.6 million in additional funds that we would have to allocate across the district. Without it would be $7.5 million.
Helen Hollins is the communications director with Mesa Public Schools.
So there's that, you know, $14 million differential. You can do a lot with $14 million to really impact student education.
Hollins says the lion's share of the district's operations money goes to salaries, wages, and benefits for their employees. And until May 17th,
it leaves a sense of unsurety with our employees to know, well, what is my compensation going to look like next year?
According to Buckley, the difference for teachers in Mesa is pretty stark.
A $2,500 raise for every teacher. That's the largest raise that teachers have seen in Mesa in a long time.
Across the valley, school districts are grappling with this uncertain future.
If it doesn't pass, the budget will pretty much look like it does this current school year. If Prop 123 does pass, we're putting all the additional funds into salaries.
Laura Felton with Paradise Valley Unified School District says teachers are looking at up to a 3.6% raise if Prop 123 passes. In Phoenix,
our employees have already gotten their contracts, and there's a contingency paragraph on it that tells them what might happen to their contract should Proposition 123 fail.
If it passes, Craig Platenik, spokesperson for the Phoenix Union High School District, says employees are looking at up to a 2.5% pay increase next year. Balls Elementary School District says they're also looking at a small raise for teachers. And in Cave Creek, the district says it would have to cut 63 positions if the proposition fails. To Buckley, the bottom line is simple.
Prop 123 will inject money into the classroom that isn't there.
But not every teacher is singing the same tune.
It very, very much worries me.
Ralph Quintana is a teacher at Don Mencendick Elementary School in Glendale, and he's the president of the Arizona Federation of Teachers, a small teachers organization affiliated with the AFL-CIO. He says some wealthier districts will be able to afford to give their teachers raises with Prop 123 money, but
it's still giving it on a per-student basis instead of looking at need, and for the inner-city school, they're just not going to be able to give the raises that some of the more affluent or rural districts are able to get.
In many inner city districts, he says money from Prop 123 will have to go to maintenance, new curriculum, supplies, and materials that have been cut for years by the state legislature.
If you're in an inner city school and a more poor school district, these things are going to permanently hurt us forever, for those 10 years.
But Buckley says there are a million students in public education right now
who you essentially hold hostage to say, we're going to wait longer to try to figure out a better solution. There's always going to be a better solution. Compromise is never pretty.
Lauren Gilger, KJZZ News.
Earlier this spring, the U of A's Rogers College of Law made the decision to give applicants the option of taking the Graduate Record Exam, or GRE, rather than the LSAT. That hasn't won the school friends at the Law School Admission Council, which controls the LSAT. Tomorrow, members of the Law School Admission Council's Board of Trustees will meet. Among the items on the agenda is a discussion about whether the U of A's law school should have its membership revoked or whether another punishment could be issued because of the school's entrance exam decision. To learn more, I'm joined by Karen Sloan, a reporter for the National Law Journal. Karen, what was the initial reaction when the University of Arizona announced its change?
I think initially there was a fair bit of surprise that Arizona was going in this direction. The University of Hawaii's Law School and Wake Forest University's Law School are also contemplating using the GRE in admissions, but nobody has actually gone for it the way that Arizona has. There's some skepticism that you're going to have a lot of people coming in with GRE scores. I think a lot of people still think that the LSAT is going to be the dominant and primary way that people are going to be applying to law school. People are very interested in this development. Admissions, new students coming to law school are down about 30% over the past 6 years. So a lot of schools are in the position where they have more seats than they have quality students looking to come.
Is the LSAT, has it been considered by anyone else to be sort of out of date or too traditional, let's say?
They do tweak it. They're constantly testing it to see if it tests what it purports to test, which is how well a student will do in their first year of law school. That's an interesting point. It doesn't measure who will necessarily make a good lawyer. It's designed to measure who will get good grades in the first year of law school. So there has been a fair bit of criticism in recent years that the LSAT isn't actually testing the things that it should be testing in terms of having a successful legal career. Change comes very slowly in the world of legal education, and perhaps even more slowly when it comes to the LSAT. So it is not a dynamic test that's changing a lot year to year.
Is there a real chance that the LSAC may really punish the U of A in the way they're threatening to?
Sending a message here. I think they're sending a message to the larger realm of law schools that they don't have a lot of patience for schools kind of going rogue, if you will, and looking at these alternatives. I think there's a question about whether or not the council is really serving the interest of the schools if it's going to try to constrain them from using only the LSAT, especially at a time when schools really are desperate for more students to come in. The council hasn't said they are going to take action in terms of booting Arizona from their membership, but even this sort of preliminary, we have to discuss whether or not you're following the rules, I think that does send a larger message.
So we know about the Law School Admission Council. We know about individual schools. What role does the American Bar Association play in this?
The ABA accredits law schools, and in their accreditation standards, they require all law schools to use the actual term they use is a valid and reliable test in admissions. So the default has always been the LSAT. So basically you have the law school's accreditor saying, you have to use the LSAT. Now, some schools have experimented in the past with using the SAT instead of the LSAT, and they've been given permission here and there to do that in very small numbers. And as far as we know, the council, the Law School Admissions Council, has never attempted to, revoke the membership of a law school that used the SAT rather than the LSAT. So it's interesting now that the GRE is seen as a potential threat to the LSAT.
Karen Sloan is a reporter for the National Law Journal.
State leaders have spent a lot of energy trying to make Arizona a leader in the biosciences. Now, someone familiar with the industry is asking whether the state's biotech community has achieved critical mass. Eric Miller wrote a piece asking that question. He's the co-owner of the Tempe-based firm PADT, which helps people who make physical products figure out how to make them. And Eric, let me ask you that same question. Has the Arizona biotech community achieved critical mass?
Yeah, I think we're either there or really, really close. The term critical mass means that it can run on its own without outside stimulus. And I feel like we're really, really close to that. And it's pretty exciting to see after the long journey how close we are and how far we've come.
I think that there are some people in the Valley who would be surprised to hear you say that, given the amount of attention that municipalities and business leaders are still paying to trying to attract more biotech companies to the Valley.
Well, I think that's part of the ecosystem, right? It's the local municipalities and independent organizations. They need to continue to keep pressure on bringing people here and growing it. It's one of those things that you can't, especially when you get so close to achieving your goal, back down. Now's the time when you have to try even harder and really put effort into it. And we can build on our successes as well. I think that's one of the reasons why you see it so much, is a lot of what we're talking about is the success we've had recently.
How would you describe the Phoenix area's biotech community?
I would describe it as very diverse and really dedicated to doing things right. It's one of the nice things about our community, because we don't have a lot of funding, because we don't have a lot of outside stimulus, we have to do things the right way. There's not a lot of fluff. There's not a lot of crazy ideas. You got to be pretty practical to survive here. And I think that's one of the things that sets our community apart. And that's, we've heard that from people outside of the state as well. Wow, people here kind of seem to have their act together. Well, we kind of have to.
Do you find that the goals that people set for the biotech industry in this state are realistic? I mean, are people trying to turn this into Silicon Valley, for example?
Well, I think we've gotten over that. I think that that was obviously the easy thing, is let's just be the Silicon Valley of this or the whatever. I think we realize that we're unique. We have unique advantages and strengths, and we have weaknesses, and we need to understand those and work to those.
The people who push for more bioscience in Arizona often talk about the benefits that those kinds of companies have on the economy. I'm curious to get your perspective on that, given that you think that we are sort of at this critical mass point.
Well, and I can speak from experience, because, you know, our company consults with people who make physical products, and we do everything, including bioscience. And in that little microcosm, we see that bioscience companies have challenging problems. There's a lot of money invested in getting there. It creates a lot more jobs. I mean, these are difficult problems to solve. So they're well paid. There's a lot of other companies that benefit from the bioscience efforts of one company. So it's not something really simple where a guy just sits in his garage and writes an application and puts it out there. That doesn't create a lot of employment. The bioscience community spreads everywhere. And then when it's out there in the community, one of the great things about the bioscience industry is it saves people's lives and increases quality of life. It's one of the reasons why we like it so much, is not only is it good for business, but it's good for quality of life.
You said earlier that you think that the efforts to bring in more biotech companies and help them out here should continue. Do you think those efforts need to evolve, though, now that we are either close to or at the point where, as you say, this ecosystem can sort of work on its own and sort of sustain itself?
Yeah, I think that's a really, really good point, and something that those involved in it are very aware of, is that you've got to continuously improve your processes, right? I'm an engineer, so we always look at things that way. And the industry and the governments are really understanding that. What worked 10 years ago and was successful needs to change now. Like, we need to focus now on getting more funding for early stage companies, and we need to focus on getting more research here in the state. We've got great institutions that do some fantastic research, and we've seen a little bit of a, that's one area we've seen a drop in. So that's something that I think everybody knows they need to focus on, is bringing more research in, bringing more funding into the state.
Eric Miller is the co-owner of the Tempe-based firm PADT. We were talking about the essay he wrote called "Has the Arizona Biotech Community Achieved Critical Mass?" Eric, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
As developers move forward with plans to build a Fry's food store in downtown Phoenix, we're learning more about the area's past. KJZZ business correspondent Christina Estes is here with new information revealed during a city meeting yesterday. Christina, first, let's get a lay of the land here. We're talking about the area bounded by Jefferson and Washington and 1st and 2nd Street, right?
Right. Right now it's a big parking lot, but in the 50s it was home to the Fox Theater and the JCPenney store. And beneath the Penneys, they built an underground parking garage that also included a bomb shelter.
So can you actually access the shelter, you know, get inside?
Well, I'm told you wouldn't want to try. The whole underground area is apparently really tight in terms of space. Right now, some people pay for monthly parking there, but the developer says It is not for most drivers. He says it's super difficult to maneuver, and he doesn't even feel comfortable walking around down there.
The developer also told you about excavation plans. Before they do anything else, they have to bring in an archaeological team?
Yes, they expect excavation to get underway later this year. It's something the same developer did a few years ago when they built Cityscape just a block away. Jeff Malosnick with Red Development told me they found the foundations for the Lures Hotel, the Wholesome Bread Factory, and more.
We unearthed the highest concentration of prehistoric Hohokam pit houses on that site. So who knows what's in store? We also found a bank vault underneath Cityscape when we started the excavation, and it was buried halfway underneath Washington Street and halfway underneath our site.
Now, he says the bank vault was crushed, and no one apparently got away with a big stash of cash.
So, Christina, what happens if they find artifacts like they did with Cityscape?
Archaeologists will collect any pieces and then analyze them away from the construction site. In the case of Cityscape, Malosnick says it took 5 years for them to do all the research, to catalog it and complete, do the entire process. He says all the items are now housed at the Pueblo Grande Museum in Phoenix.
So this is not the only interesting thing that we're learning about this Fry's store, right?
Yeah, two other points that are pretty important for people who are going to shop there. One, I'm told prices should be similar to other Fry's stores. So just because it's downtown doesn't mean they're going to jack up prices. And second, shoppers should not have to pay for parking.
Always an important topic for downtown visitors. We've posted some images of what the Fry's will look like. There's other information as well on our website, kjzz.org. KJZZ's Christina Estes. Christina, thanks.
You're welcome.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
My name's Becky Mayhew. I'm here today with my son. We're volunteering for a few hours helping clean up the trails.
Cyclists!
Morning.
My son got busted for breaking curfew and has to do 10 hours of community service.
Well, seeing as how I just love this area so much and stuff, and I go hiking here a lot, it's not really that much of a punishment. We're just kind of filling up washes and stuff with rocks. That way it doesn't wash out the trails.
Try and throw some up here. Perfect.
Also clearing the trails for the runners, the horses, bikers.
Yeah, attaway, attaway.
I really need to, you know, help the community stay the way it is. That way I can enjoy it the way that it is at the moment.
That's Becky Mayhew and her son Reese fixing up the Moonlight Trail in Santan Mountain Regional Park. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just think we could use some refurbishing, send us a note, the show at kjzz.org.
A new ordinance will take effect in Tempe a week from Saturday. It prohibits people from sitting or lying on the sidewalk in downtown Tempe and from sitting or lying on anything not permanently attached to the ground. Tempe Councilmember Robin Arredondo Savage supports the ordinance.
First and foremost, I think it's a good idea because it was something that was brought to our attention a little while ago with some concerns, not only from some of the residents, but the downtown community. And they had some concerns about the different behaviors. And we thought that, I believe, too, that this is just a really good compromise for where we used to be with our old ordinance to really having no ordinance now. And it's a good balance to try to really work and just change the behaviors that are happening in downtown.
How do you go about trying to quantify exactly how businesses might be affected by folks sitting on the sidewalk in front of their establishments?
You know, I think it's just like anything, and my responsibility is to make sure that we listen and hear some of the concerns that are happening and completely understand that maybe sometimes it's not quantifiable so much, but in the sense that a lot of it is sometimes perception, and sometimes the perception is negative, and we want to make sure that everybody's experience downtown is a positive one. So we can work together. I know that homelessness is a problem, not only in the city of Tempe, but other cities and really across the nation. And it's much bigger than just what's happening in downtown.
What do you make of the argument that ordinances like this are basically trying to crack down on the homeless?
Well, as you probably know, this ordinance applies to everybody. It's not here to criminalize anyone. And I have full faith in our police department, the downtown authority, and what they're doing and what we're trying to accomplish, which is hopefully make that connection with these individuals and be able to point them to the proper services
that they may need or they've been looking for and maybe just haven't had that opportunity yet. So I look at like this is something that hopefully can be helpful, will change the behaviors, and then we continue to not only provide resources for supporting services, but also look to do more and different things to help fill some of those gaps that really can change, I think, the bigger picture when it comes to homelessness.
But even though it applies to everybody, homeless are often seen as the ones who would be most affected because they are the ones who, in many cases, don't have anywhere else to go. So I guess, do you feel confident that there are other services in the city, other places for folks who don't have a home to go where they can get off the sidewalk in downtown Tempe and get the services they need?
You know, I do. I do think that there are a lot of resources out there. I don't ever think that there's enough. And I think that, like I said, we can always do more. I think one of the biggest issues comes to housing. And we hear that not only with homelessness, but those people that are right on the verge of being homeless, emergency housing is a really big issue.
This ordinance takes effect in a couple of weeks. I'm curious, once that happens, if you and your colleagues will be watching to see how it's implemented, how it's working, and if you might be willing to make some tweaks down the road if you feel they're needed.
You know, I have, like I said before, I have the utmost confidence that a lot of it's just going to be first and foremost about education, making sure everybody knows about the new ordinance and what's in place. And then it's not really about giving citations. That's never really what it was all about. That's not it. It's about changing behaviors. And so actually one of the things that is different within this ordinance is that a warning is required before any citation is ever given. But of course, I think I can't speak for everybody, but I always say, hey, let's give it a try. Let's do this. Let's implement it. And if after a year we see that, you know, it's not working the way we wanted to, absolutely, we can certainly make some tweaks.
Tempe Councilmember Robin Arredondo Savage. The ordinance has drawn protests. Homeless advocate Charlotte Walenzik has organized a group called Tempe Homeless Outreach Team.
The ordinance, I think that it's completely just stepping on people's human rights. Like, the businesses are saying these people aren't good enough to be in our site. They're an eyesore. They claim that they're driving their businesses, you know, their sales down. And I just think that that's completely ridiculous. And I think that we need to address the problem of homelessness instead of just pushing it out of the way.
So you don't buy the business's argument that having people sitting on the sidewalk in front of their establishments is bad for them?
I understand that maybe it's bad for them, but the businesses went on Mill Avenue, like, by choice. They weren't forced to go into Mill Avenue. They could have gone into Tempe Marketplace. The homeless people have been on Mill forever, and it's not just on Mill. In any central business district in the country, there's going to be homeless people panhandling. That's just how it is. It's like a staple in any central business district. So I don't understand why they think they're going to get rid of them, even with the ordinance. All the homeless people that I've talked to, because I've went and done some outreach and spoken with everybody about it, everybody claims they're just going to keep on doing it. They're just going to get tickets. They're going to stand up and do it. They're going to sit on the benches and do it. They're going to probably bring chairs from whatever and do it. But they're not going to just stop, because that's their only source of income. That's the only way they eat. You know, especially during the summertime, a lot of them say that they panhandle at night to get a hotel so that they don't have to be out in the heat of the day, you know, the next day. And I just don't understand how we can cut that source of income off from them. You know, I think it's about survival.
Do you think that Tempe does a good job as far as trying to have services available to help people who are on the verge of becoming homeless to not, and then helping people who have become homeless to sort of get back on their feet?
I think that there is absolutely no shelters in Tempe. There's no resource centers in Tempe. There's a couple churches that give away food and to give them a shower about like once a week. It's just absolutely like completely inadequate. We're one of the only cities that doesn't even have a homeless shelter, and we also have an anti-camping ordinance. It's like, it's just so backwards, because these people basically have no choice. They're not allowed to sleep in on the streets. They're not allowed to sit on the sidewalks, but they have no other option for how to survive. So no, I don't think that Tempe is providing adequate resources, because we don't have a shelter. We don't have a resource center. We don't have anything.
Charlotte Walenzik is with the group Tempe Homeless Outreach Team. We are talking about Tempe's new ordinance banning people from sitting or lying on the sidewalk in downtown Tempe. It takes effect a week from Saturday.
It's The Show with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix.
And I'm Phil Latzman. We've been hearing all week about the pros and cons of the education initiative Proposition 123 that goes before Arizona voters this month. Hey, but what about that other item on the May 17th ballot? You know, the one that deals with pension reform? What's that all about? If it's confusing, here's a useful analogy.
You can sort of think of it as an oil spill. First thing you do in that situation is you cap the spill and try to stop the problem from getting worse. And that's what Prop 124 is really aimed at doing.
Leonard Gilroy is a Fountain Hills resident, and he's director of government reform at the nonprofit policy think tank Reason Foundation. That oil spill is Arizona's pension fund for police officers and firefighters. It's less than half funded and has been underfunded by nearly $7 billion over the past decade.
That's really the hard, difficult work of slowly cleaning up the spill after you've capped it. Nothing that in Prop 124 will immediately wipe away the $6.6 billion in unfunded liabilities that the state's accrued. But over time, the entire package of reforms will basically do that.
So, Leonard, you're here. Let's dig into a little bit more of this. The key provision of this initiative, which just came through the state legislature and must also be approved by voters, as per the state constitution, would be to cap cost of living increases to the fund at 2%. But with so much money to make up, is that kind of just a drop in the bucket?
This piece that is going to voters is an important part of the entire package. And if you have to really look at the entire package as a full package. So if you look at all of the components together, we believe that what it will do is essentially stop the bleeding that has been happening in the system and then ultimately put the public safety retirement system on a track to solvency and really reduce risk to taxpayers, reduce long-term cost and risk to taxpayers and employees in the system.
How did things get so out of hand? I mean, how did the formula for these pensions get so out of whack?
Well, there are many factors, but there are really two. One is that for many years now, the system has really failed to meet its high assumed rate of return in the system, meaning it expects to get somewhere between 7.5% to 8% annual returns in the marketplace. It has consistently not been delivering that when you smooth that out. The other piece is this broken mechanism that I talked about, which Prop 124 would address. And what that really has done, it's got some major flaws, this permanent benefit increase. So that mechanism has been a major contributor to that $6.6 billion in unfunded liabilities that you mentioned.
So it seems like this is a slam dunk. There's no opposition to it. When people walk into the voting booth not knowing anything about this, are they just going to rubber stamp it?
Well, we'll see what the voters say. I think you do point out that there isn't any opposition to it, and I think part of that has to do with the process by which not just Prop 124, but the entire package of reforms that were enacted, how that came about. And that really came about through something we have not seen much nationally, which is public safety unions, legislators, the governor's office, League of Cities, county associations, taxpayer groups like ours, that all really came to the table. And while they didn't agree on maybe what they each thought the solution should be, and they each come with a different perspective, they were ended up being able to hammer out a consensus on a reform package that will reduce the risk to taxpayers in the long term and will really provide that retirement security for retirees in police and fire systems statewide.
And we see this playing out in municipalities and cities and states all around the country, this pension reform. How does the Arizona plan compare with other plans that are being proffered elsewhere?
I would say that the Arizona reform, in addition to having that stakeholder collaboration process, which is very unique, and I think that is really a model now moving forward for other jurisdictions on tackling this difficult issue. But about 10 states, including Arizona, have shifted at least one of their state systems to some sort of alternative structure.
Leonard Gilroy is director of government reform at the Reason Foundation. He's based right here in the Phoenix area. It's a nonprofit think tank specializing in public policy and pension reform around the country. And Len, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
The NCAA Board of Governors has adopted a new requirement for sites who want to host events to make sure they provide an environment free of discrimination and safeguards for the dignity of those involved with the event. This matters to Glendale, which will be hosting next year's Men's Final Four. Joining me to talk about this is Jennifer Campbell, Glendale's Assistant City Manager. And Jennifer, what does the city think about the step taken by the NCAA?
Glendale is a very diverse and inclusive community. Glendale's taken several steps already to make sure that we've got protections against discrimination in our city. A couple of things that we've done actually is council adopted a unity pledge in December 2014. They also helped to provide some direction, and we implemented some anti-discrimination language in our city contracts and procurement policies in January of 2015. After that, they also directed us to hire a consultant and to hold what we called community conversations, which was our way of reaching out to our local businesses and residents to see how people felt about discrimination and a possible policy here in Glendale. After we did that, we went ahead and presented the results to the city council to kind of let them know how the community felt. Also here, our Convention and Visitors Bureau and the Chamber of Commerce have also signed that unity pledge, basically saying that Glendale is open for business. One of the things that we are looking to bring to council shortly is the creation of a human relations commission here in the city of Glendale to help address diversity and inclusiveness.
The proposed ordinance that you referenced generated a fair bit of controversy and divisiveness in the city and within the council. Is that something that you think that the city and or the council might take up again at some point?
We are going to continue those discussions. I think one of the first things that we'd like to do is to create that human relations commission, which is a way of making sure that we're engaging our residents. Anytime you look at passing any type of ordinance resolution in the city, you need to make sure that we have proper notification and basically proper inclusiveness of the people who that ordinance or resolution may affect.
Did the NCAA reach out to the city at all while it was discussing this or maybe before it announced this new policy?
That, Mark, I do not know. Not that I was aware of it. It didn't come to our office.
Does the fact that the Final Four is coming to Glendale next spring, does that speed up the timeline or adjust the timeline in any way of some of the things that you referenced the city is working on right now?
Well, we're going to continue down the path that we've already kind of started on. And like anything, you want to make sure that we do it right. And sometimes doing things right takes a little bit of time.
Do you get the sense that there is a sense of pressure to have something more in place or be further along than you might have been otherwise, given this announcement from the NCAA and the timing of the Final Four?
Currently, I don't think that we feel that.
Jennifer Campbell is Glendale's Assistant City Manager. Jennifer, thanks.
Thank you very much, Mark. Appreciate your time.
Millions of Americans will celebrate Cinco de Mayo with a lot of partying while wearing sombreros and fake mustaches, and that has made many people of Mexican descent feel disrespected by this form of cultural appropriation. The group Mecha de Brown at Brown University is trying to get people to think more about the true history and meaning of Cinco de Mayo. As part of that, they've introduced the hashtag #ReclaimCinco. To learn more, I'm joined by Catherine Chavez. She's on the executive team of Mecha de Brown. Catherine, what is most troublesome about how many people will mark Cinco de Mayo?
It is a holiday, and if you want to participate in some sort of celebration, then fine, go ahead. But I think it becomes problematic when people start to dress up in a certain way and sort of take on this image of what they believe to be Mexican. It really perpetuates a stereotype that as a Mexican woman, and many other students have expressed a similar sentiment that I think is quite dehumanizing and I think really doesn't portray us in a way we want to be portrayed. And it's a holiday that is unique to not only Mexico, but also to very specific parts of Mexico, and no one really knows the history when they celebrate it. So celebrating something without really understanding what it is, why it's a holiday, is also problematic. And that's one of the reasons that we started this effort in the first place, was not to keep people from celebrating, but to make sure that people knew what they were celebrating and were educated on what this is really about. A lot of people think of it as Mexican Independence Day. That's not what it is. Mexican Independence Day is September 16th, and this is commemorating a completely different time period in history.
Rather than getting bogged down with things like Cinco de Drinco or seeing it as simply a chance to have a party, are there messages that you and the rest of your group have tried to get people to think about?
One of the very first things we released as a part of the campaign is this graphic that is called Alternative Ways to Celebrate Cinco de Mayo. It starts first with just educating yourself and taking the time to learn really the meaning behind the holiday and the history behind the holiday. Secondly, we think that people should try supporting authentic Mexican businesses. If you want to do something specifically Mexican to celebrate the holiday, then like, why not go out to a local Mexican restaurant run by a Mexican family and support, you know, the group of people who the holiday ultimately belongs to? We also want to highlight that sort of idea of celebrating responsibly. We don't want people to be dressing up and wearing fake mustaches and doing kind of all of these things that we see are being marketed by party stores and this image that is really stereotypical and dehumanizing, as I said before. And lastly, there's this interesting contrast between people celebrating this Mexican holiday on this specific day, but in the media recently, there's been a lot of negative language and negative sentiment towards immigrants from this country that people are now deciding to celebrate. So we want to say that maybe take Cinco de Mayo to think about a lot of the immigrants who have come from this place and maybe donate to an organization working for immigrant rights. One of the things that we say on this graphic is, if you celebrate this holiday while disrespecting the people whom it belongs to, shame on you. Any day is a good day to start recognizing the equality of all people, no matter where they've come from.
What kinds of reaction has the group, have you received to the efforts? I mean, are people apologetic? Do they feel like, wow, I just didn't know that. And now that I do know that, yeah, I'll approach it in a different way. Because some people can be somewhat resentful if they think that you're accusing them of being racist, for example.
There was this party planned by a group of people here in Providence that they were, you know, going to celebrate Cinco de Mayo, and they are asking people to dress up in that stereotypical way that I've been talking about. And we found out about the event and were very much opposed to it and really didn't want it to be celebrated in that way. And so we kind of took to social media and really called out the people that were trying to make this event happen. And they have ultimately said that they're going to cancel it. One of the members of our group was eating in one of our dining halls and overheard a couple of people talking about that. And people said something along the lines of, yeah, you know, it sucks to be called out, but if you're going to plan an event and not take into account the culture behind the holiday that you're celebrating, then, you know, you need to kind of reevaluate what you're doing. And that was sort of felt like for all of us that we had really achieved something, that people were talking about it and like acknowledging that there are problems with the way that people are acting pertaining to this holiday.
Catherine Chavez of the group Mecha de Brown at Brown University. Saturday
is the Buckeye Demolition Derby. And between the smashing and crashing of cars is the halftime feature, lawnmower racing. If you're thinking, wait, mowers? That can't be as thrilling as wrecked cars. The show's Annika Klein says, not so fast.
This one's been clocked at over 80 miles an hour.
Like a lot of the racers in the Arizona Lawnmower Racing Association, Marty Faust grew up mowing lawns at a snail's pace.
I was growing up on a farm, and we had 5 acres of grass to mow every week, maybe 5 miles an hour at the best.
But with some tinkering, you can get a lot more power out of these machines.
We are reinforcing the steering on this one.
David Calvert is the president of the association.
From past crashes, we had some bent linkages.
He's fixing up a green and black mower at his gas station and auto repair shop in Buckeye.
This is a proven race winner.
Calvert used to be a demolition derby driver himself, but left the world of trashing cars to do what the mower racers call kicking grass. Yeah, the puns write themselves in mower racing, but that doesn't mean the sport is just a gag. Here's racer Donald Stone.
I mean, I've wrecked this one.
You wrecked this mower?
Yeah, I flipped it.
It looks so friendly.
Yeah, well, it weighs about 300 pounds, so the steering wheel landed in my gut.
I was the one that ran into him. He clipped the wall in front of me, and it sent him sideways, but then he rolled over the finish line. I pushed him across first, and I got second.
It definitely sounds like one of those don't try this at home warnings you see on TV, except that both Calvert and Stone did see this on TV, and that's why they decided to try it. Stone says he saw it on Duck Dynasty.
Turns out they were getting ready for a lawnmower race.
And he picked up his mower the same afternoon. Bruce Kaufman is founder and president of the U.S. Lawnmower Racing Association, based in Illinois.
It's taken off because of the media coverage we've had and the ease and affordability to get in. The more, the merrier.
But it's still a pretty niche sport, with about 800 members nationally. Calvert says his club hovers at about 20 members. One thing that is growing is Calvert's hometown, Buckeye.
When I grew up, the town was only 3,000 people, but now we're 50,000 plus. So we're trying to hang on to some of that, you know, old-time feel.
For Calvert and the other racers, the lawnmower has always been an icon of rural life. These just blow your hair back a bit more. For the show, I'm Annika Klein.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.